Well, you look a little more energetic this morning than you did last night, which is normal. I'm a little more energetic too. And unfortunately for you, I'm a morning person. Last night, we talked about step one. We talked about the foundational knowledge that we're going to build everything we are going to have as a structure on, and that's the doctor's opinion. And when we talk about the doctor's opinion, when we talk about step one, we're talking about the powerless condition of mind and body. And if I cannot eat because of the allergy, and I cannot keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, then I am powerless over food. What is it that I'm looking for in food? Do I sit there and say I want to be even fatter so I can split more chairs? Do I say I want to be even fatter so I can break more car interiors? No. What I'm saying is I want to feel better, and I want to feel better immediately. And how I talk myself into it is I deserve the food, I need the food, I want the food. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm just going to have one. And that monkey chatter in my head is what's going on. And what I have found in life is that God makes life very, very simple. In other words, if I don't have that committee in my head talking myself into something, then the answer is yes. And if I have to talk myself into it, the answer is no. But just knowing that is not going to keep me out of the food. Just knowing that is just dieting. But if I can't eat because of the allergy, and I can't keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, looking for that effect that I get, that the normal person does not get, you don't hear a lot in OA about what the food does for us. You only hear about what the food does to us. But if it didn't do something for you, you wouldn't have been attracted to it. And what it does for you is it gives you that effect. And that effect, again, is the sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly from eating a Butterfinger bar. It doesn't come from eating broccoli. It doesn't come necessarily from eating, you know, abstinent food. It comes from eating candy or bread or pizza, whatever it is, because it just gives you that effect. Now, the powerless condition of mind and body is something that we're going to build on this morning. And what we're going to do this morning is we're going to see what happened in the life of a guy named Bill Wilson. And Bill was born on the 26th of November, 1895. He had a sister, Dorothy, that was born about 2 years after him. And Bill's father and grandfather were alcoholics. Bill's grandfather went up to Mount Eolus in, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, in Vermont. And he had a spiritual experience as the wind blew through him and through him. And he never found it necessary to drink another day in his life. But Bill's father, Gilman, was not so lucky. And Gilman Wilson was an alcoholic. And in 1906... Gilman and Emily Wilson divorced. And Gilman and Emily Wilson went their separate ways. And Bill Wilson and Dorothy Wilson were left in the care of their maternal grandparents, Fayette and Ella Griffith. And they were their grandparents. Bill was actually, ironically, born in a tavern. He was born in an inn that had a tavern, and his birthplace today is a National Historical Site in East Dorset, Vermont. Bill was born and raised in East Dorset, Vermont. Bill was a very thin, very tall, gangly guy. If you don't know what he looks like, there are bazillions of pictures of him on the internet, and there are pictures of him in some of the AA literature that is approved. Books like AA Comes of Age and Pass It On and some of the other ones, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Bill was a very determined child, and he wanted to prove to the world that he was somebody. He was the type of child who found a violin in his grandfather's attic, and he practiced on that violin so much that he became co-first chair of his school's orchestra in the violin. He found an old baseball glove up there, and he practiced and he practiced, and he became the starting shortstop and co-captain of his school's baseball team. He also read one time as a child that only an aborigine could fashion a boomerang that would actually come back to you, and he worked tirelessly, and he made a boomerang that actually came back to him, and as it did, it almost killed his grandfather because it whizzed by Grandpa's head, but he actually got the boomerang to come back to him. And Bill was a very sad child, and he suffered from depression. His mother went to Boston to become one of the nation's first female osteopathic physicians. And Bill's father left East Dorset, Vermont to go to Western Canada. East Dorset, Vermont is where much of the marble and granite and lumber comes from. Some of the granite and marble is so rich there that the marble adorns many of our nation's monuments that are in Washington, D.C. Some of our national buildings have cornerstones and stuff that are made from the marble that comes from East Dorset, Vermont. So Bill's father went to where he knew he could get employment, where they had the same type of resources, which is in Western Canada. And Bill felt very abandoned. And divorce in 1906 was quite scandalous. It isn't like you see today where it's almost commonplace. I'm divorced. I've been divorced for 4 years. And I still kind of have that stigma like, gosh, I'm a divorced guy. I never thought that would ever happen to me. I really didn't. And 4 years ago, my then wife came in and said she's going to divorce me, that she had fallen in love with someone else. So I still kind of, you know, have to shake that off at times that I'm a divorced person. But in 1906, it was very scandalous, and Bill really felt it. He suffered from depression. When he was 17 years old, he was in love with a girl named Bertha Bamford, and Bertha Bamford went to New York City to get an operation, which was supposed to be quite simple, quite routine, and she died. And this is before Lois, but Bertha Bamford was the love of Bill's life, and she died, and when she died, he fell into the very first of his many deep and many very serious depressions. He suffered from this depression all of his life. If you're with me and you have a big book in front of you, please go to page 1. Bill was 43 years old when this book was written. I do not believe that Bill wrote the book. I believe he was just God's scribe. And I will always believe that he was God's scribe. He had 3.5 years of sobriety. I have 15 years of abstinence, and I'm lucky if I can write a coherent postcard, let alone one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen. But God picked Bill to be the scribe of this magnificent work. And this book that I'm holding in my hand, and hopefully you're holding it in your hands too, has restored more gluttons, more gamblers, more alcoholics, more drug addicts, more sex addicts, more whatever that you could think of, back to society and put more families together and restored more lives than all other methods of combating addiction combined. This book right here has done the work that thousands of generations of people could not accomplish. And it's right here, it's in your hands. And what does it cost now? $8 or $10 or something like that. And if you come to our meetings in Scottsdale and you can't afford the book, we will gladly give you one for free. So that's how easy they are to obtain. Page 1. War fever ran high in the New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned, and we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last, and in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. I forgot the strong warnings and the prejudice of my people concerning drink. In time, we sailed for over there, and when he says over there, that denotes World War I. When I was very lonely, I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he died by musket or by pot. Now, I want to point out that this pot that he's talking about has nothing to do with marijuana. He's talking about a beer, and that's the way they drank beer in England in those days. You're talking the 1600s is when this actual tombstone is dated, and they used to drink it warm out of pint pots and quart pots. And they would stand when they would drink. It was considered extremely bad manners to sit and drink. And that's why in the saloon, they had a bar that the guys could lean against. And the barkeeper, when these guys would get a little tipsy, they'd start getting a little drunk, he'd say, "Watch your pints and quarts over there." And as that expression of "watch your pints and quarts" came over to the colonies in the 1600s, 1700s, the colonialists made it "watch your P's and Q's," and that's how that came into our language today. But even as an homage to those days when you stood and drank, a bar stool like this one right here is always raised above the level of a kitchen chair, a dining room chair, or a living room chair. But in those days, it was considered very bad manners to sit and consume alcohol. See, we give you everything here. We give you a little Yiddish, a little etymology. You know, we give you everything. This is a full service retreat. I know you were going to get all this when you first came here, did you? Okay. Ominous warning, which I failed to heed. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I went home at last. I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation, my talent for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises which I would manage with the utmost assurance. I took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. My work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money. Some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Now, what are we seeing in the life of Bill Wilson, and how does it parallel to at least me? That his liquor consumption, his alcoholic condition, and alcoholism is the allergy of the body and the twist of the mind, is now starting to slam doors in his face. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years of age. I was physically and emotionally emasculated by this illness. I have had 30 hours of plastic surgery to remove the aprons and the skin from around the groin area and the stomachs that developed over time. I've had 30 hours of plastic surgery. But I have been emasculated in the mind in other ways too, because when I saw a goal, when I saw something good, I immediately recoiled from it because I assumed that it could not be mine because I was fat. It could not be mine because I didn't look like the other kids. It could not be mine because I was bad and they were good. And the minute that you got to really know me, you weren't going to like me, because you were going to discover a side of me that I didn't want you to see, that was really who I was, and that came to me through various other people. And I have had sponsorship in this program that is far beyond what I ever could have deserved. And somebody very wise said to me many years ago, "You can begin feeling better about yourself today. Just start doing self-esteemable acts. Just start doing the things that draw you closer to God and further away from that self-loathing." It takes action after action after action. But Bill Wilson is experiencing in his life, he is reaching to be a lawyer, and alcoholism is slapping his hand away, just as my compulsive overeating slapped my hand away. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. What is the first victim of compulsive overeating?
Truth.
The truth. Thank you. The truth. Honesty. The first thing to go out the window when this illness is practiced is honesty. He is lying to Lois, and he may believe it. He may believe that BS himself. I hope not, but he may believe that BS himself that these things are true. But the very first thing to go out the window is the truth. By the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and management, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed the theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. Now, I want to point this out because it's important. When he says we saved $1,000, you have to know that that's a lot of money. We're talking the 1920s. And if you ever want to play around on your computer and get off the porno sites for just a minute, go to the Chicago Tribune website. Go to the Chicago, I don't think it sometimes has it. Go to the Tribune website and look up prices in Chicago in the 1920s. You could buy a decent house in Chicago at that time for probably $1,500, $1,800. Now, I'm talking a decent house. I'm not talking a mansion, but I'm talking a decent house. You could get a brand new Ford at that time for $495. You could get a brand new Dodge at that time for $400 or $500. So you had an opportunity in 2014 to look at $1,000 and think to yourself, gosh, I've got credit cards in my pocket that have higher limits than that. But in the 1920s, $1,000 was doctor money. It was very, very good money. So he's doing well. That's the reason I point that out. Not to give you a history lesson, but to show you that he's doing very well. We gave up our positions and off we rode on a motorcycle, the sidecar stuffed with tented blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Now, before I go further, there's something I forgot to mention. At the time that Bill Wilson was on Wall Street in the 1920s, you could literally put a chimpanzee in this chair and put the chimp with a dart and tell the chimp, throw the dart, chimp. And if it hit Bob, that's no big deal. But if the chimp hit the board and he, whatever stock that the chimp hit with the board, if you put down about a 10% margin and invested in that stock, you'd make money. Just like we had the big boom of the early 2000s, they had the boom too. But what was Bill seeing that very few people saw? That this is not going to last forever. That we need more information on these companies that we're investing in, and the people that he was looking at, or the people he was working with, were saying, nah, we don't need that information. My God, Wilson, haven't you made enough freaking money? What's wrong with you? How much money do you need? And he says, no, we need this information. Thanks. We need this information. Well, he was cunning, baffling, and powerful too, and off they roared on the motorcycle. Okay, page 3. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had had some success in speculation, so we had a little money, but we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. By the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there for the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for the year, for that year. You're talking, he's making doctor money. He's making surgeon money. He's making very, very good money. Now, remember that Bill Wilson was not really a stockbroker. He calls himself a stockbroker here in the book, but he wasn't. What he was a New York City stock speculator. And as a speculator, he sold his opinions as a consulting fee to other people, and they would invest in what he thought would go up and make them money, and they cut him in on the profits. Right now, everything is working for him. His alcoholism is not really getting in his way very much. He's the darling of Wall Street. People want to be his friend. Let's see where we go from there. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. Here's the kid from East Dorset, Vermont. Never had anything in his life. He is on Wall Street, and he is the darling of Wall Street, or one of the darlings of Wall Street. Those words, I had arrived. Now let's look at the next sentence. My judgment and ideas were followed by many, to the tune of paper millions. Now, could you just imagine, whatever it is you do, let's just say, for example, that you own an HVAC plumbing company, and you own this company, and let's just say, for example, your name was Bob. Okay. So people come from all over the country to see how Bob does the plumbing and the contracting. And how he does it becomes the standard of what is done. And if somebody over here is not doing it the way Bob does, they say, wait a minute, you're doing it wrong. Bob does it some other way. Now, could you just imagine what that would do for your ego? Let's read this again. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Millions of dollars are getting invested because of his opinion. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and shattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends. Now, people want to be his friend. They want to be around him. They want to catch some of his juice. Just like you'd want to be around somebody that came in here if they were very wealthy or a movie star or a TV star or a big successful whatever it is. You'd want to be around them too. But let's see where his alcoholism takes him in just a couple of sentences. My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends, that means his friends are getting on him about his drinking, terminated in a row, and that row is a disturbance, it's a quarrel, it's a fight. And I became a lone wolf. So in just a couple of sentences, he goes from having a host of fair weather friends to being a lone wolf. What was the thing that he was doing, if it's the same thing I've done? He was choosing his alcohol over his friends because his friends could not do for him what John Barleycorn could do for him. And there's no girl, there's no boy, there's no llama, no aardvark, no otter, no beaver that could do for me what a Kit Kat bar or a Butterfinger bar can do for me. And a Butterfinger bar, a Kit Kat bar, Raisinets, can give me that effect. And the effect is that sense of ease and comfort that comes over me instantly when I eat those things. The only problem is when I eat them, I also trigger the physical allergy so I can no longer control the amount of them that I consume. So he is choosing that effect, and that effect is what I have been chasing since the minute I was born. And that effect is only something that is done for us
because of this illness, but unfortunately, the destruction, the hurricane destruction comes to us because of that physical allergy. And the allergy is that adverse, abnormal reaction that comes about when I consume those foods or certain amounts of foods, making it impossible for me to stop once I have started. So he's choosing liquor over the friend. He's choosing liquor over the success because he cannot make another choice. He is powerless. He is powerless. Is he consciously making that decision? No more than you did when you did the same thing. No more than I did when I did the same thing. And there are decades of my life that I will never get back. And there are hundreds and hundreds of Saturday nights when I spend alone listening to music and crying my eyes out in front of the television set, and my food got real salty at the end. My friends would be out, it'd be a Saturday night, it'd be a Friday night, and they'd be out with girls, and they're getting more rear-end than a toilet seat at O'Hare Airport, and they're out doing their thing, and I'm home in front of the television set, and I would have a couple of frozen pizzas, and maybe some Kit Kat bars, or maybe some Butterfinger bars, or whatever it is I had. And I would promise myself I wasn't going to finish this grocery bag full of goodies in one night. And I'd be sitting there and I'd be eating and I'd be crying, and that's how my food got so salty. And I'd be crying from the toes and I'd be crying where I can't breathe. And I would be saying to myself, no, no, stop, don't do it, stop, don't do it. And by the time I was conscious, the food was gone. It was gone. Because once it was inside of me, I couldn't stop. Everything I ever wanted, everything I ever dreamed about was out there. And everything I wanted to do was eat more food. And that food had that adverse, abnormal reaction. And in most human beings, excess food acts as a barbiturate. You've seen them on amateur night, right? Thanksgiving, belt open, hair comb post on the couch, right? You've seen them all, the amateurs? Mm-hmm. Not me, baby. That food acts as an amphetamine in my system, and it gets my fat feet going up. More food, more food, more food, more food. They don't react that way. They don't react that way because they don't have that effect, and they don't have that allergy flowing through their system. And my food got so salty because I was crying into it. Help me out here. Where am I? Oh, there were many unhappy scenes in my apartment, right? Is that where I am?
Yeah.
Okay. In our sumptuous apartment, there had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes. I love Bill enough to leave that alone. In 1929, I contracted gall fever. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud, while I started out to overtake Walter Hagen. When he says Walter Hagen, just think Tiger Woods or what's the other guy's name? McElroy or whatever. Yeah. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan one sees upon the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, in October 1929, all hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. Remember we talked about that when we talked about Silkworth? Well, here it is. Here's Black Tuesday, October 29th. 1929, the entire world will be plunged into the depth of a Great Depression. And when America coughs, the world gets pneumonia. And it wasn't just bad here, it was bad everywhere. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning.
I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Make note of the fact that he's looking down his nose at the people that were jumping off the buildings. Now, why were those guys jumping, essentially? Their God was dead. Everything they had was tied up in the stock market, and the stock market was plunged into a depression. Their God was dead. But Bill, without knowing it intellectually, what did he know in the back of his mind when he says, I went to the bar? He knew he could get the, starts with an E, ends in a T, effect from the whiskey. He could get that effect, that liquid courage. And you know one of the things about that effect? It makes tomorrow look like great news. Because tomorrow I'm going to go on that diet. And tomorrow I'm going to get that girl. And tomorrow I'm going to get that money. So he went back to the bar. Okay? My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Why did that fierce determination to win came back as he drank? Because he was in the clutches of that effect. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. That was his friend, Dick Johnson. Dick Johnson says, get up here. He had plenty of money left and thought I had better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. Sorry. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke. Elba is where Napoleon returns from and reconquers, and St. Helena was where he was banished to, and that was his end. That was my goal. We went to live with my wife's friends, my wife's parents. Now, before I continue, I want to again remind you what we're reading. And you know, you'll see some goofball in a meeting that'll read this stuff, and then they want to share about what their counselor says, or they want to share about what the dry cleaner did to them, or how rude their mother-in-law was to them. You're living in 2014 in a very egalitarian kind of world. Let's go back to Bill Wilson's childhood. Or you don't even have to do that. I'll tell you about my childhood. I was born in 1954, and I was born on the north side of Chicago. And as little Jewish kids, we're taught by our parents, and we're taught by the parents of our friends, and I learned a lot from the parents of my friends, more so than I did from my parents, because my parents were comatose from food, and my mother was out of her mind. But the bottom line is, I learned a lot, and what they taught us was this. A girl may love you, but she will not starve to death for you. You better provide her with a roof over her head. You better provide her with clothes on her back, food on the table. And once a year, you better take her on a nice vacation, or she'll find somebody that will. They'd say, she may love you, but she's not going to live in Greenbrier Park with you under a bench. Not going to happen. Now, Bill is married to Lois Burnham, and Lois Burnham's father is Dr. Burnham. Dr. Burnham did not like Bill Wilson at all. Lois had an ectopic pregnancy and almost bled to death, almost died. And they couldn't find Bill because Yutz was out in some bar drinking, getting drunk. Dr. Burnham thought that Lois married a guy that was a complete Yutz. She also married a guy that was a couple of years younger than her. And Dr. Burnham didn't want Lois to be with this guy. She didn't like him at all. Now here's the guy that's the darling of Wall Street just a couple of years earlier. He's got the big apartment. Remember he said it's a sumptuous apartment? It was. You remember he was telling you how people were following him to the tune of paper millions? They were. Now here he is with his tail between his legs going back to the Burnhams to live with them. And you can just imagine what Bill and Lois's domestic life was like, because here's Prince Yutz coming back to live with Dr. and Mrs. Burnham, okay? We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job and lost it as the result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hangout at brokerage places. Lois gets a job at Lowman's department store, and she's on her feet in high heels and all put together for maybe 12 to 15 hours a day. She leaves in the morning, and Bill is there, no shave, no shower. All she says to him is, please clean yourself up. Take a shave, take a shower, and while you're at it, could you put the breakfast dishes in the sink? Just do that much. Just put the breakfast dishes in the sink. She comes home. He's still drunk. He still hasn't shaved. He still hasn't showered. And the breakfast dishes are still on the frickin' table. Could you just imagine what their life is like? And her parents are in the other room and they can't stand him. So just imagine the reality of what he's living in. Just imagine where he's at. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Now, I came here to Santa Barbara yesterday. I could have just taken this sentence, liquor ceased to be a luxury and became a necessity. I could make a whole retreat just on that sentence. That sentence has so much substance into it that I could talk on that sentence ad nauseum. Bathtub gym, 2 bottles a day and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few hundred dollars and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. That's called delirium tremens. When you see these guys and they're shaking. Now, I am not an alcoholic, but I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years. And if you live in Eugene, Oregon, you have to go to AA. There is no OA to go to. You have no choice. And I sit in the meetings of AA, and you see these guys, and they couldn't even put a cup of coffee to their mouth. They couldn't get, I mean, they would spill half of it because they couldn't get it in their mouth. They're shaking so much. They look like a dog trying to crap out a peach pit. I mean, it is just amazing how they shake like that. Well, the unfortunate thing about that is the heart is also a muscle. And if the heart becomes affected, it's goodbye, Charlie. And he's shaking like that, and the only way to calm these guys down is to give them more liquor. And that's just an unfortunate situation here. Okay, a tumbler full of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required. Required is the key word in that sentence. Required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. So Bill sees that he cannot drink. He sees his life is going to hell in a handbasket. So what does he do with his liquor that we've done 100 times in our life? He goes on a, starts with a D, ends in a T. Diet, thank you. He goes on a diet. He is trying to clamp down on his consumption of liquor through sheer willpower. And of course, we know that he cannot do that. And his wife gets very excited because he's got a couple of minutes of sobriety. It's 10 to 10, and he hasn't had a drink since 20 to 10. And she gets very excited that he's had 10 minutes without a drink, and she's all full of, you know, happiness. Gradually, things got worse. Oh, how did that happen? I thought he went on a diet. Oh, the house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. This is something that takes place in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And last year in April, I had the pleasure and honor of doing a retreat like this in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, which is right near Cherry Hill, New Jersey. These guys from Cherry Hill knew that Bill was a good investment counselor. He knew his stuff. And they approached him, and they asked him if he could put together a deal. And he was on one of his diets, and he says, sure, I'd love to. And nobody knew anything about alcoholism, but they met in a hotel in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And by the way, I had dinner in Cherry Hill, New Jersey on the Saturday night of that retreat. So I was very, very happy to have been there. But anyway, they go into this motel room, and this is in the days of Prohibition. And a guy comes in with a jug of whiskey that he made himself. You know, just like your aunt made the bread for you, or your aunt made, or your grandmother made the cake for you, and you have to have some. And besides, it's vegan, or it's vegetarian, or it's kosher, or whatever, you got to have it, right? So this guy, they're passing around the whiskey, and it goes around once, and Bill doesn't take any. And the guy says, hey, Wilson, I made this myself. This is Jersey Lightning. Now remember, he had just promised all of them that he wasn't going to get drunk. He says, I made this myself. It's called Jersey Lightning. You can have one snort. So with no more thinking than anything, he just pops that snort of Jersey Lightning. And he didn't come out of that motel room for 3 days. He was so dead drunk, he couldn't come out for 3 days. And of course, he has to go home and tell Lois, and he has to go home and tell everybody that he got drunk again. And let's see where he goes from there. I went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. So once again, the alcoholism was pulling the rug out from underneath his feet. And how many times has my compulsive overeating pulled the rug out from under my feet? Against my will, and I'm crying thinking God hates me, and I'm crying thinking there's no point to life. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take as much as one drink. I was through forever. He's back on a diet. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. What? Wait a minute. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. He said he meant business. What the heck? There had been no fight. Where had been my eye resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way and I had taken it. Was I crazy? So he's beginning to question his own sanity here. I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed in mere being just that. Renewing my resolve, going back on my diet, I tried again. Some time passed and confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time. But I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. Now he was half drunk before the liquor went in his mouth. Notice he says, I went into a cafe to telephone. They didn't have a telephone at the funeral parlor. They didn't have a telephone at the gas station. They didn't have a telephone at the flower shop or the candy store. No, he went into the cafe to telephone because he knew in the back of his mind that he was going to get a drink. What was he looking for before he took that first drink? He was looking for the, starts with an E, ends with a T, and he was looking for the effect. What part of his illness drove him into that first drink? The mental twist. The mental twist seeks out that effect. So the mental twist drove him into that first drink. Once the mental twist got the effect, it was satisfied, it stepped out of the picture. What took over and made him get drunk? The physical allergy, which means that the more he drank, the more he wanted. The more he wanted, the more he drank, and it's just endless. It was just endless. And so that is what drove him. So as we see the machinery of his illness, as we see the nuts and bolts of his illness, can we relate stronger? I hope so. If you are a person that is afflicted with compulsive overeating like I am, this is exactly what happened in my life 20 bazillion times. When we get to step 11, we're going to talk about taking our daily guidance. If Bill had taken his daily guidance, he might not have gone to a bar to make a phone call. He might have gone somewhere else. The remorse, page 6. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. It was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me that the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then the mental fog settled down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. Now, remember back on page 4? You remember when Bill was looking at these guys going to kill themselves on October the 29th, 1929, Black Tuesday? Do you remember what he was thinking as he saw these people killing themselves? He almost laughed in their faces. He says, I went to the bar. What is he thinking now? He's thinking of killing himself now because he has nowhere to go. He has tried everything ad nauseum. He has done everything he knows to do to stop drinking like this, and he cannot do it. And so he is cornered. He is absolutely cornered. And he is thinking of killing himself too. And I thought about killing myself many times. I had many suicidal thoughts. Many of them. I did not want to live in this world. I saw no point. I was alone. I was lonely. I was starving to death for attention. I was starving to death for affection. I was starving to death for sex. I was starving to death to belong to a family. I was starving to death to live my life as other people. When I look around these retreat centers that God has sent me to over the years, and sometimes I look around and I can scarcely believe the beauty and abundance of my world today, coming to a place like this, when all I could think about was Kit Kat bars, and all I could think of, you know, this is Saturday night, baby. I'm rocking and rolling with my threesome, me, Little Debbie, and Sarah Lee. And when all I can think of is me, Little Debbie, and Sarah Lee, and every once in a while we'd invite Ben and Jerry and make a whole Caligula type orgy out of it, you know, we'd invite them too. But the bottom line is, look around at the beauty of this place. It's unbelievable where God has sent me. But right now, he's not feeling that. All he's feeling is there's nothing he wants to do more than drink, and nothing he wants to do but get sober. All I ever wanted to be was thin, but all I ever wanted to do was eat. And a house divided cannot stand. It cannot stand. Excuse me, where am I? Somebody help me out here. Where's Jordan?
The mind and body.
The mind and body. Thank you. Sometimes when I lose my place, do you know who George W. is down in Oceanfield in North San Diego? He always holds me to my place. And when he comes to, when I do the big book study, and I've done it a couple of times, but I don't know who's going to do it this year, unless you do. I make him sit up front because he holds me to my place. Okay, the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms for mine. Endured this agony 2 more years. It is amazing that I was able to withstand the physical pain and the emotional loneliness of this disease. It's a depraved way of living. Sometimes I stole from my wife's purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture were so hellish I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. There he is with those suicidal thoughts again. A doctor came with heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative. Wow. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight. Now, is his being 40 pounds underweight or someone being 100, 200 pounds, whatever it is, overweight any different? It's the same thing. It's just manifested in a different way. Now, we're going to start to see something
And if you're awake, and some of you are not, I get that. And I'm trying to talk low.
But we're going to start to see the munificent, benevolent hand of God as He reaches into the dark, freezing, shimmering cave of alcoholism and gluttony and addiction, other addictions. And He is beginning now to reach out His hand, and we're going to start to see some of the miracles. Now, let's take a look at the next paragraph and let's see where we go from here. Now remember that his little sister Dorothy is married to a doctor, and his name is Dr. Leonard Strong, and Leonard liked Bill. And Bill's mother at this time is an osteopathic physician in Boston. My brother-in-law is a physician, that would be Dr. Len Strong. Through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Now, of all of the drying out places that Bill could have been placed in, he is placed in the town's hospital in New York City. Of all the doctors on staff that could have been assigned to him as he came in, he is now going to come under the care of a doctor who has a theory rather than just a hopeless attitude about these drunks. And he's going to come under the care of Dr. William Duncan Silkworth. Is it odd or is it God that these things have occurred? Is it odd or is it God? I choose to think that it's God. Now, let's see where we go from here. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug, like Prozac. It fooled the brain into thinking that it had alcohol in it, so these guys would calm down. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise help much. Hydrotherapy doesn't do really anything for you. It just makes a clean drunk out of you. And they bring these guys in and they hit them with hot water and cold water and hot water and cold water. It doesn't really do anything. It just makes you, you know, hydrotherapy just makes you feel good, I guess. Best of all, now, if you don't really pay attention, I'm trying to hold it down if I'm disturbing some of you, they're sleeping. I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily, the allergy, and mentally, the twist. Now, he knows what's wrong with him. He knows the problem. Let's see where he goes on self-knowledge. Let's see where he goes, where he goes on this self-knowledge thing. Because remember, Dr. Silkworth doesn't have a solution for this problem. He's observed the problem. He believes that the problem is what it is, and he's right. Yale University, in their alcoholic studies program every single semester, proves that he's 100% correct. That there is a discernible difference in the brain waves of an alcoholic drinking, a compulsive overeater eating, a sex addict looking at porno, a drug addict using drugs. There is a difference in the brain waves. That he was right all along. Now let's see where we go. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself, now I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. The goose hung high means things were good. Goose is a symbol of wealth. It's a symbol of abundance. That means things were good. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. So Bill had been in the hospital once. Now he's going to return for the second of the 3 visits that we're going to read about this morning. And what does Dr. Silkworth know now that Bill Wilson is back yet again in very short fashion? that he is one of those guys that he has determined to be a hopeless alcoholic. If you remember last night, we talked about Dr. Silkworth observing many of these men who came into the hospital and they never came back once they were released. But Bill Wilson is one of those boomerang guys, I like to use that word because of the boomerang story from his childhood, that has indeed come back. And here he is again in worse shape than Silkworth saw him the first time. And Silkworth is about to tell Lois Wilson what he has told other women in the past or other people in the past around the alcoholic, that there's nothing he can do for Bill. Let's see where he goes from there. Where am I going here? Okay. But it was that, for the frightful day came when I went to, right? Ski jump after a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish. Okay, that's where I'm at. The curtain had seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain. A wet brain is really a dry brain. When these guys would get drunk, the alcohol would suck the hydration out of the cells. And the cells of the liver and the cells of the brain do not rehydrate. And that's why these guys wake up and it's like they swallowed a sandbox. And they're so dry they can't, and they just need a little nip of a dog to bit them. Well, what happens with wet brain syndrome, at least Alzheimer's has the mercy to kill you. Wet brain, these guys can last in these hospitals for decades. And they come in, and they change their diaper, and they feed them, and they plop them in front of the television set, and then they change their diaper, and they feed them lunch, and plop them in front of the TV set, and this just goes, and this is their life. They're institutionalized for the rest of their life. They know nobody, they know nothing. They have wet brain syndrome. And honestly, at least Alzheimer's has the decency to kill you. But this, you can live like that for decades. She would have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. When doctors would tell me that I was going to die, I wanted a day at a time so I could just cram as many Kit Kats, Raisinets, Doritos, and Butterfingers as I could possibly get in there so that at least I could go with a full stomach. So the first thing God would see when he welcomed me to heaven was, he'd go, "Phew, why do you fart so much?" Okay. They did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself, of my abilities, my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now, before I go on, I'm going to keep my finger on the place. I'm going to bet something. If I could go around this room and I could get to know every one of you, I would be astounded at what some of you have accomplished in your life. There are people in this room that are very accomplished human beings. There are people in this room that have raised families. There are people in this room that have gotten advanced college degrees. There are people in this room that have accomplished things that are the envy of other people. But there's one thing I know you cannot do. No matter how smart you are, no matter what your weight is, no matter what your personality, what your religion is, no matter whether you're Jew or Gentile, black or white, green or yellow, short or tall, it wouldn't matter what you are. You cannot control the amount you eat once you begin because of the allergy, and you cannot keep from eating because of the twist of the mind. On your own, by yourself, not going to happen. And this is astounding to so many of us. And I think that there are people that are too dumb to work, that are too smart to work this program, but none too dumb. There are people that have accomplished these things, wow, and they get in the way. And it gets in the way because you think to yourself, you should be able to do this on your own. You're smart enough. No, you're not. You're good enough. No, you're not. Because this is something that only a spiritual awakening will conquer. And we've talked about, I hope I did, I'll say it now, Bill's story is definitely divided into two parts. The first 8 pages, we're on page 8 right now, are divided into, the first 8 pages are about Bill's plunge into alcoholism, but the second 8 pages is about how a recovery therefrom was affected in his life by a spiritual experience. I use the word experience rather than awakening because that's the word he uses, because his was sudden and profound. We'll get to it in a minute. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining the endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. No better description ever written about this illness in step one. And they didn't have an AA for him to go to. And they didn't have an OA for him to go to. And he is defeated. If you play chess, he's checkmate. He can't go here, he can't go there, he can't do this, he can't do that. There is nowhere for him to go. He is dead in the water. He is just, there's nothing for him to do. Trembling, I step from the hospital. This is his second visit. He's leaving the hospital. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of the first drink. And on Armistice Day, 1934, that would be November 11th, what you would know as Veterans Day. Armistice Day is what they called it before World War II. But it was the armistice of World War I, November 11th, 1934. I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. Now we have the three dimensions of width, height, and depth. And the fourth dimension is the dimension of the spirit. And you do not have to wait until page 83 to get promises in this book. Let's read this paragraph. He says, fourth, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dare hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight. Now, before we read the next paragraph and before we break for potty, I want to tell you a backstory that's not in the book. And we're going to see in this story, if somebody is sound asleep next to you, we'll hold it down. But pay attention to this part, because we're going to now see how a solution is going to come to the world. Is Bill Wilson the first person to get the information on the illness of the mind and the illness of the body from Dr. Silkworth? Absolutely not. He told this to hundreds of people. But what we're going to see is how the solution came in. What is the solution to this? If nothing of this earth is going to solve Bill's problem, then God is going to have to effect something that is going to change the course of the world. And he begins this process in 1933. In 1933, there was an alcoholic named Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard came from Rhode Island. And Roland was a very, very wealthy industrialist alcoholic son. Roland Hazard's family owned the majority of a company called Burlington Mills. And if you've ever walked on carpeting in your life, you've probably walked on Burlington carpeting. Chances are good. Now, carpeting is not made with natural fibers, natural material. So they also owned a very huge amount of stock in a company called Allied Chemical, which is traded still to this day. Allied Chemical is still a very large company and is traded today. And Roland was their wayward alcoholic son. And Roland wanted to get sober. And what he did was he actually went to great lengths to try to get sober. You know, at one time in his life, because of his wealth, he actually had himself stranded on a Caribbean island. And the master of supply, the guy that came and brought him his groceries, his stuff, I guess, whatever he wanted, was told not to bring him any liquor. And while he was on this island, he managed to stay sober very easily and fine. But unfortunately, as we know, once he got off the island, the first thing he did was get dead drunk. Now there were many, many coincidences and many, many things happening at the very same time to make us able to be here this morning in 2014. Roland, after getting off the island, getting drunk, seeing that that gambit didn't work, he decided to seek out, in 1933, the services of who then was the preeminent psychiatrist in the world. Psychiatry in that time was in its infancy. It isn't like it is today. And we assume psychiatry has been around forever. Not true. Not true at all. And it was in its infancy then. And the most preeminent psychiatrist in the world at that time was a guy by the name of Sigmund Freud. And Roland sought out his services, and Freud wasn't taking on any new patients. But Freud's number one protege at that time was a guy named Dr. Adler, and Dr. Adler was not taking in any new patients at that time. Now, there was a guy in Sweden, and he was the number three psychiatrist in the world, and his name was Dr. Carl Jung, J-U-N-G, Jung. And Dr. Jung psychoanalyzed Roland for a year between 1933 and 1934. And he psychoanalyzed Roland, and he kept Roland, you know, going with all these analysis and all this, and Roland was managing to stay sober. And in the spring of 1934, Dr. Jung tells Roland that he thinks he is fine enough to go back to the States and resume his life as a person. Roland goes to the shipyard in Sweden. Now, even though Lindbergh had already crossed the Atlantic, the way to get across the Atlantic was still mostly by boat, by ship. Roland goes to the shipyard, and lo and behold, guess what they have in the area where you wait for your boat? They have a bar. They have a saloon in there. And he goes in, and he gets so drunk he can barely see straight. And he goes back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung tells him, "Crap, I misdiagnosed you. You're not any of these things I thought you were. You're an alcoholic, and you're doomed, and you're going to die." And Dr. Jung said this to Roland, and Roland said to Dr. Jung probably the same thing you might have said to him. "Doctor, please help me. I don't want to die. I want to show my mother that I can get sober. I want to live my life. I have everything to live for." Does that sound familiar? Dr. Soper said that in what we read last night? Okay. But don't confuse Dr. Soper with Dr. Jung. It's two separate things. Now, is it odd or is it God that Roland got to Jung because Freud believed that all solution lie within the mind? And Dr. Adler believed that all solution lie within the mind. But Jung broke rank with them in one area only. He believed that here and there, once in a while, there were people who had experienced spiritual experiences that could alter and change their attitudes, behaviors, and it would do something for them that would catapult them into a different direction of their life. So is it odd or is it God that Roland got to Jung rather than Adler and Freud? Now, in the spring and summer of in the summer of 1934, Roland Hazard goes back to New York City, and he does not want to go to a conventional church. He doesn't want to go into a conventional religion. And in early summer, late spring of 1934, Roland Hazard seeks out the Cavalry Mission in New York City, where they are doing the Oxford Group Movement. The entire Oxford Group Movement was founded by Frank Buckman, who was a Lutheran minister, and he lived in England near where Oxford University is located, hence the name the Oxford Group Movement. And Frank Buckman believed that Christians were losing their enthusiasm for Christianity.
And he said, early Christians were willing to be put to death to prove their devotion to Christ. And he says, we have lost our enthusiasm. There's an interesting word, enthusiasm. Entheos from God. Entheos from God. Okay? So he goes to China on a mission. And he sees that there are people in China who are enthusiastic and happy and spirited in their devotion to Christianity. And what is it that they're doing? Not thinking, not saying, but doing, that is setting them apart, is that they are seeking ways to be of service to their fellow human being. Does that sound familiar, like what we're doing? Does that sound like our 12th step? I sure hope so. And he sees that these Christians in China on these missions are enthusiastic about their Christianity because of service to others. And one of his disciples was Sam Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker was in charge. He was an Episcopalian minister. He was in charge of the cavalry mission in New York City. And Sam Shoemaker would later become one of Bill Wilson's spiritual mentors, but he is welcoming Roland, and Roland is making a friend in a guy by the name of Sebra Graves Jr. There's a name you don't hear all the time. Sebra, C-E-B-R-A, Graves Jr. And another guy by the name of Shep Cornell, who was like their closer. He'd go in and, you know, convince you to come in there and anything. But anyway, he and Sebra Graves Jr. are alcoholics who do not know the problem of alcoholism, but they know that they're doing the six steps of the Oxford Group movement and they're staying sober. Now let's go to Albany, New York. Let's leave Shep and let's leave Sebra and let's leave Roland alone for just a minute here. We're going to put the pause button on them. We're coming back to them, I promise you, but we're going to go to Albany, New York. We're in the 1934 mayoral elections in Albany, New York, and Mayor Thatcher is running for re-election. And Mayor Thatcher is seeking another term as mayor of Albany, New York. And his wayward drunken son, Edwin Ebbie Thatcher, is causing a problem with his drunken behavior. And Mayor Thatcher says to his drunken son, Ebbie Thatcher, get the hell out of here. You're going to cost me this election. What is wrong with you? Why do you keep pulling these shenanigans and getting drunk? Go to the summer home in Manchester, Vermont. And Manchester, Vermont is a place where very wealthy people had summer homes, which was outside of a place called East Dorset, Vermont. And we know who was born there, Bill Wilson. And Ebbie goes to Manchester, Vermont, just to show you the loftiness of the Thatchers. Mayor Thatcher's golf buddy was Robert Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son. That was his golf buddy. Well, anyway, Ebbie Thatcher goes to Vermont, and he's painting a wall. And as he's painting the wall, pigeons are landing on the roof. And he doesn't like what pigeons do to his freshly painted wall. So he gets his shotgun out and starts blasting the pigeons off the wall. Well, neighbors, they don't take kindly to this. They call the police, and the police come, and they arrest Ebbie Thatcher. And they say to him, look, Thatcher, you pull one more shenanigan like this, you're going to Brattleboro Insane Asylum, which is what they did with alcoholics in that time. It's in Brattleboro, Vermont. You're going to the loony bin if this happens again. Well, sure enough, a little time later passes, and Ebbie is dead drunk, and he drives right into a woman's kitchen with his car. He's driving drunk, drives right into a woman's kitchen. And he doesn't show the slightest remorse, not the slightest contrition. He says to her, hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee? She calls the cops, and they drag him down to the police station, and he is about to go before the judge in summer of 1934, early fall of 1934. He is about to go before the judge to be remanded to the Brattleboro Insane Asylum in Brattleboro, Vermont. Now, while Ebbie is getting into this mix of trouble,
Roland goes back to Rhode Island to show his mother and father that he is indeed sober. They're thrilled. I'll teach you a Yiddish word. They're quelling. To quell means rapture beyond what you can describe. It's sort of like the Jewish mother goes to the inauguration of her son, who is going to be the very first Jewish president of the United States. And somebody says to his mother, "You must be so proud today. Your son is going to be president of the United States." She says to her, "Yes, but my daughter's a doctor." So that's spelled. But anyway, Roland Hansard goes home, and he shows his parents that he is indeed sober, and they say to him, "Roland, go on a vacation. We'll pay. Wherever it is you want to go, you're working so hard to go to get sober. Whatever it is, you go, we'll pay." So Roland goes back to New York City, and he says to his friend Sebra Graves Jr., that he could go on vacation with Sebra and that his parents will pay. Where could we go to have a good time? And Sebra Graves Jr. says in late August, early September, "I know where we'll go. Let's go to my family's home in East Dorset, Vermont." Now, it is now September of 1934, and Roland and Sebra Graves Jr. are going to East Dorset, Vermont for a vacation. And if they go the week before, I'm dead. If they go the week after, I'm dead. They just happen to be there the week, is it I or is it God? They just happen to be there during the week when somebody that they knew of, that they had heard about, named Ebbie Thatcher, was about to go before the judge. Sebra Graves Sr. was the judge of the case. Is it odd or is it God that Sebra Graves Jr. and Sebra Graves Sr. are from East Dorset? Is it odd or is it God that it was his dad who was the judge? And they go to Sebra Graves Sr. and they say to him, "We know this man, we know of this man, why don't you remand him to our custody? We'll take him into the Oxford Group in New York City. We'll take him to the cavalry mission and see what we can do with him." So before Sebra Graves Sr. lets that happen, Ebbie has to sign extradition papers, and he has to sign papers that say that if he doesn't do what these men tell him to do, this is September of 1934, that he is to be immediately extradited and remanded immediately to the Brattleboro Insane Asylum. Ebbie goes into the Oxford Group meetings in September of 1934. September to October, he puts together 1 month of sobriety. October to November, he puts together 2 months of sobriety. It is now November of 1934, and he is tapped on the shoulder by somebody at the Oxford Group and says, "You need to go give testimony." And he says, "What's giving testimony?" And they say, "You've got to go and tell others what we have done for you. Any Jewish holiday that you've ever known of, they tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat." But the bottom line is they're tapping him on the shoulder and saying to him, "Go give testimony." So he turns around and says, "I don't want to go give testimony." And they say, "Well, you could go to the insane asylum." And he says, "You know, maybe I'll go give some testimony." So he's thinking very hard of who he can approach in New York City and give testimony to and not embarrass himself. And he thinks about his old drinking buddy, Bill Wilson. Bill and Ebbie did a lot of drinking together. They got drunk many, many times together. They knew each other very well. Let's take a potty break and we'll be back here in 5 minutes. We have two time zones. That time zone and this time zone, so I don't know what's right. It's 10:30. Let's come back by 10:35, because at noon I know one thing. It's lunchtime and I am going to be...